We are very, very pleased to welcome her today. It is a very interesting thing to see on Ms. McCarty's bio sheet that she was the president of a farm implement company for some years and had an international harvester retail dealership in Indiana, and that she was also a farmer and for many years before that. And it interests me to see, and I'm sure it would interest you too, to see how a farmer becomes a U.S. attorney. So without any more hesitation, Virginia Dill McCarty.
Thank you. When the procedure started for my nomination for this office, which is presidentially appointed and confirmed by the Senate, I was not aware that I would be the first woman for a full four-year term. And in fact, the Justice Department thought I was the first woman ever. They then discovered by diligent research that a court had appointed a woman in 1917, and President Wilson had appointed her for one more year, which made me think they tried it and didn't like it. Last year, when I was running for Attorney General of Indiana, Governor Eleanor Grasso of Connecticut came out to help me campaign because we have never had a woman elected Attorney General in the United States either. Governor Grasso said she thought it's too bad that in this day and age we're still talking about the first woman to do this and the first woman to do that. My remark to her was, well, better now than never. And I think that's happening all over the country. When I started thinking about why is it that there has never been a woman in this job, I found several explanations. One is that until a few years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, I would say, among the lawyer population in the whole country, only 3% were women. And from 3% of any group, you're not likely to find very many rising to the top. I think there's a lot more to it than that in this particular job, because the United States Attorney is seen as a law enforcement officer. Like the Attorney Generals of most of your states, the United States Attorney for a district also conducts the civil litigation for the government. But the public image is that of the old radio show that some of you will remember, which started with dot, 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 dot. And it was a two-fisted he-man who went out there and got all those criminals. In the time I've spent in the prosecutor's office and in the attorney general's office in Indiana, I have discovered, and many prosecutors and attorney generals and United States attorneys are discovering, what most of us as women knew all along. In spite of having a reputation for and a stereotype for being the softer of the two groups of human beings, most readily apparent, we are at least as interested as men in seeing that persons who do harm to society are taken out of society and confined so that they can no longer damage us. And in fact, sometimes I believe that women are victims more often than men, because so many women are dependent upon men for their economic and social status that they are not even given the opportunity to make the decisions themselves as to what happens to them, whether they make poor investments with a con man, whether they live in a neighborhood where crime is rampant. They have to rely on their husbands to make all of those decisions for them. I do know from Indiana, which no longer has Indians, despite the common view, and I wish it did, but I do know that my great-grandmother, when the Indians were there, and when predators of Caucasians would go from farm to farm and area to area, that my great-grandmother was just as ready to pick up a gun or a broom or a poker or whatever was necessary to defend herself and her children and her husband and home as my great-grandfather was. And perhaps that I have inherited some of the pioneer spirit. I was very fortunate in my upbringing. Some places in my life I've been in the right place at the right time. Not always. But if it happens to you a couple of times, I think you're lucky. And if you're looking, you'll be able to take advantage of it. I was brought up to believe that it was my duty as a citizen to realize my full potential. And it was also my duty as a citizen to participate in the government. The way we participate in our government generally is through politics, and that both of those are responsibilities which every human being, both male and female, must assume. I did discover on getting out of law school that that's not what most people, especially law firms, thought, which was kind of a shock. However, I also am a living example, and I see some of you might be interested in this, that life can begin at 40. Because after staying home for 11 years with my children and being a part-time lawyer, very part-time, mostly being in the home, just a few days before my 40th birthday, I was sworn in as a Deputy Attorney General for the state of Indiana. Now, I had been looking for several years for employment as a lawyer, which would occur when my children went back to school, and I had found nothing. The reason I was in the right place at the right time was that a man I knew very vaguely in law school, but who happened to be of my political party, was elected Attorney General. He was willing to take the chance. He remembered that I got good grades, you see. That made it easy. And so, because he was willing to accept that, and the members of my party were willing to urge me to run for office, I grew from a person who was very insecure, who thought the men, lawyers, had 11 years on me, who was the kind of person who stood in the corner at a party, and if anybody wanted to talk to me, they, by gosh, better walk over there, because I wouldn't go talk to them first, to the point where I enjoy making speeches, I enjoy meeting people, and I guess a moderate amount of success at it. At least I feel it's very rewarding. And I do want you to know, too, that it's been very interesting in the hard decisions that a prosecutor must make and the hard staff decisions that United States attorneys or any other bosses have to make. I've learned two things. One, it's fun to be boss. And two, there hasn't been a single time when I've really had a hard time making my mind up.
Our next speaker is Pat Danner. She serves as the federal co-chairman of the Ozarks Regional Commission. The ORC is a federal-state partnership concerned with planning, fostering, and accelerating orderly economic growth and development of the states of Arkansas, Kansas, Louisiana, Missouri, and Oklahoma. Mrs. Danner is the first and the only woman to serve in this position. She has a degree in political science from Northeast Missouri State University. She has long been active in community volunteer programs, including the Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, Red Cross, Home and School, and the Tuberculosis Association. After many years of political activity as a volunteer, she served for 3.5 years as district assistant to the late Congressman Jerry Litton, Democrat from Missouri. She also worked on the Carter Mondale campaign. Mrs. Danner is presently listed in 4 prestigious publications, World's War, Who's Who of Women, and Who's Who in Government among them. I'm sure it'll be a pleasure to learn something about the ORC and Ms. Danner.
This is rather like diamonds, you know, small but select group. I think that I'll cut short my remarks so that we can have more time to enjoy visiting and answering questions. There were several points I wanted to make because both Virginia and I are very, very much interested in politics, and if we have some indication that you are too, then that's what we'll discuss today. For quite some period of time now, people have been asking, where is women's place in this world? And to that, I would have to respond that it's every place. In biblical times, we know that Mary and Martha were in the home when Jesus was there speaking to some of the men, and Martha came out and complained to Jesus that Mary was not helping her in the kitchen, but was instead sitting and listening to what Jesus had to say. And Jesus said, "Mary has chosen the best part, and it shall not be taken from her." I think that those sentiments would apply to some people today who would hope that women would not enter fully into the political arena. Several of us here today, indeed I hope all of us here today, are going to change that. The change has been a long time in coming. For over 200 years, women in America have been trying to get into the political mainstream. Remember, Abigail Adams wrote in a letter to her husband, John Quincy Adams, President of the United States, "We," meaning the women, "threaten to foment a rebellion unless our opinions are taken into consideration." Well, if Abigail Adams was here today, she would learn that we have been taken into consideration in that we do have the franchise. We do have the right to vote. But we have not been fully represented. Today, as you well know, there's no woman who serves the United States Senate. Of the 435 representatives in our country, only 18 of them are women. And maybe Virginia might be the first, but at this point in time, we have never had a woman serve as Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. But we're equally responsible for bringing children into this world, and I think we're equally responsible for making it a better world for our children and their children to live. I've had a very interesting experience in politics, as was mentioned. I have been active in politics for a few years, but not so awfully many years, so that I hope it would give any of you hope who might be thinking about embarking in politics to know that it's never too late, and life does certainly begin at 40. My political career began just a little sooner than that, although not too much. In 1970, I was at the post office one day when a friend who was really a local Mr. Democrat happened to be there. And my son had just received a letter. He was a junior in high school, and I had secured permission from him to open the letter if he should receive it, because we felt that it would contain some good news, and indeed it did. It indicated that he was one of the finalists for a trip to Washington, D.C., all expenses paid, 10 days. And that was quite exciting because he'd never been to Washington. And our rationale was, if he survived the first cut, that he would have a good chance in the personal appearance portion of the contest. And that did prove to be true. He subsequently did win the contest. But that day I was euphoric. And anything reasonable, anyone would have asked of me, I would have complied. And Homer Phillips said to me, "We need you badly on the Democratic Central Committee. Won't you please file for committee woman of Hudson Township?" And the reason he was more or less pleading was because I had declined on a regular basis for quite some time. I was very active in volunteer organizations, but I had not been politically active. Well, I left the post office and went straight to the courthouse and filed for Hudson County Committeeship. And I won that position. 2 weeks later, when the newly elected committee men and committee women, and as you know, there are a like number of men and women on the committee, when they met, I was selected to be chairman of the committee. Now, that might have been flattering to someone, but I learned, and as well I knew at the time, that I was probably selected because no one wanted the job. It can be a job that is very demanding and somewhat problematical. 2 weeks later, when the chairman and vice chairman of the congressional of the counties in the 9th Congressional District met in Hannibal, Missouri, I was chosen vice chairman of the 9th Congressional District. So I was really moving full force into politics. One day in the spring of 19, I might mention too that in 1970 I worked in Stuart Symington's reelection campaign. Well, one day in 1972, early in the spring, I received a phone call from a young man named Jerry Litton. And he told me that he was getting ready to run for Congress from the 6th Congressional District. And of course, Missouri, as was every other state, was being redistricted because of the 1970 census. and there was some talk that part of my county might be put in the 6th Congressional District. I told him quite candidly I hope that did not happen because I was busy going to the east part of the state for meetings for the 9th Congressional District, and I couldn't afford to go to the west part of the state if my county was divided in half, and that perhaps as importantly, I do not think, it's my own personal philosophy, that a county chairman should be involved in a primary campaign. It develops schisms in your party that are difficult to heal when it's time for the general election. We terminated our conversation. I wished him much good luck. And only a few months later, my husband and I and our 4 children moved to Kansas City, Missouri, to a suburb, Gladstone, Missouri. And after we got settled, the children were swimming, and they had lots of friends, and I was so new on the scene, I had not met anyone. And it was a presidential year, and there was much to be done politically, and I was eager to get involved. And I talked to Stan Fike, who was Stuart Symington's administrative assistant. And Stan said that they were getting ready to open the senator's office for the campaign, and that they would like to have me serve them as a volunteer. You can always be busy in politics if you want to volunteer. One day, while I was working in the office, Stan received a call from Jerry Litton. And I told Stan that when he terminated his conversation with Jerry, that I would like to congratulate Jerry on his primary victory and wish him well in the general election. When I spoke with Jerry, he said, "Where are you living? What county?" And I said, "Well, as a matter of fact, I'm living in Clay County. I voted for you in the primary." And he said, "You must manage Clay County for me in the general." And I said, "Well, I can't do that. I've only lived there a few months. I don't know any people there. I don't know territory there. I have a brand new automobile, and I won't even drive it in Kansas City because I'm accustomed to driving in a small town. My 18-year-old son is driving me everywhere until I become a little more acclimated to the area." 3 phone calls later, I finally agreed to accept the position on a trial basis, and he would see if I was operating the campaign satisfactorily so far as he was concerned, and I would see how I liked it. Needless to say, I stayed with him throughout the campaign, and during the campaign, just before it ended, I received a call from a bank telling me that they were establishing a women's division and that they very much were interested in having me head it up. And I told them that I could not do it before the end of the congressional campaign because I thought that would be unfair, but that if the position was still open at that time, I would be very much interested in it. My minor is in economics, and I thought banking was much more stable than politics ever might be. When Jerry was elected, and I drove him to the airport one day after the election, he and Sherry, his wife, were flying to Washington to look for a home, and he was going to hire some staff. He said, "Pat, I want you to be my district assistant. Find a secretary, find us an office, get everything settled and set up." And that was a surprise to me because we had never discussed the fact that I might work for him after the election. And had I thought a lot about it, I would have assumed that he would expect me to be secretary. Right, girls? No matter how hard you work in the campaign, you become the secretary and they bring in a fella to head up the office. It happens constantly. I was with Jerry 3.5 years, and in 1976, just last year, Jerry filed for the United States Senate, and I filed for the House of Representatives to run for his seat. It was a never-to-be-forgotten part of my life. Needless to say, I did not win. There was a field of 7. I came in 2nd. I learned that even Joan of Arc campaigned and crusaded only once, and it was indeed that, a crusade. I did not have any funds, including all of my travels. We spent less than $30,000. The man who beat me spent over $250,000 because he was a multimillionaire, and when one has all the money they can possibly spend, I think that political office often is the next thing they look for. And I see some heads nodding, so some of you can think of similar situations. And as you know, the law now provides, as it did not in 1972. In 1972, candidates were restricted in the amount of personal income they could spend for a campaign. That is no longer the case. My campaign had been predicated largely on the fact that the man Jerry had defeated very narrowly in the primary in 1972, defeated him by only 1,600 votes, and who knew a lot about the gentleman who ended up winning the campaign, would get into a verbal fight with this gentleman over the gentleman's background. That did not happen. It wasn't until several weeks after the primary election that the Democrat who won the seat had his campaign general manager call a press conference and say, people in the 6th District don't vote for this man, and he elucidated many, many reasons. And the bottom line is the gentleman lost after spending, according to the newspaper, $488,000 on his campaign, and the Republican won and now serves the 6th District of Missouri. If that automobile dealer who was the campaign manager had called his campaign or called the press conference a little sooner, it might be different. We can never tell. It's difficult to run as a woman, not only because it's difficult to raise money. Our friends, the other women that we associate with, oftentimes do not have a lot of discretionary income to invest in the campaign, whereas I'm sure all of you have seen the same thing I've seen time and time again. One fellow walk up to the other fellow and say, hey, give me $50. The other fellow does, and he says, you bought 10 tickets on, you know, something that my son's grade school is raffling off. I've seen that happen so frequently. It's an old boy network, and until we have an old girl network, it's going to be difficult for us. I ran in a very conservative district, and many people said a woman would not have an opportunity to win in that district. But I simply outworked the other people I did beat, and that included three state representatives. On election day, 13 hours at the polls, I stayed outside working the polls those 13 hours, and no other candidate, because some inquiries were made, no other candidate did that. Nevertheless, on election night, I was at my campaign headquarters, and I had just arrived there. My husband had not arrived there yet. In our family, I'm on time and he's late. And a friend came to me, and I knew something was amiss because I was hearing all this buzzing and people running to one another and whispering, but nobody seemed to want to talk to me about what was taking place. And Mike came to me and he said, Pat, let's go in the back room. And I thought something had happened perhaps to my husband or to one of our children. Instead, he told me that Jerry Litton and his wife Sharon and both their children, as well as the pilot and co-pilot of the plane, had been killed as they took off for the victory dinner in Kansas City.